From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There have been different names over the centuries, but there's always been an emotional impact for soldiers who fight in a war. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a name these days, but whatever you call it, Native Americans describe it as a wound to the soul. They see it as a spiritual crisis, so ceremony is a critical part of the remedy. These ceremonies are about community and empathy and telling stories. And the producer, Taki Telenidis, has explored these traditional practices designed to prepare a warrior for combat, but also to heal them when they return. Taki's documentary film is screening next week in Salt Lake City. He's joining us to talk about how Native American spirituality is being used to heal a warrior's heart. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For decades now, the U.S. military has been looking for the right way to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. They've tried different programs and therapies and medications. But a few years ago, the producer Taki Telenidis discovered there already was, in fact, a system, a process, one that was in place for centuries, designed to prepare soldiers to go into a fight and then heal them when they return. Native Americans developed rituals and ceremonies for the warriors among them. These traditional practices have, in many ways, similar elements to conventional therapies, talking it out, for example. But there are less tangible parts, too, like spiritual cleansing and telling war stories and initiating a person back into the culture as a returned warrior. There are those who say that these ancient practices can help all veterans of war. So Taki Telenidis made a documentary film about all of this. It's called Healing the Warrior's Heart. It's screening in Salt Lake City next week, and so today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Taki. Taki Telenidis is a senior radio editor for Reveal. It's a radio show and a podcast produced by the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. When he created the film, he was a media producer for the Western Folklife Center, where he created these radio features for NPR and documentaries for public television. He directed Healing the Warrior's Heart, along with the co-producer Gary Robinson. And we'll give you details about this screening next week, a little bit later in the program. Well, I guess I wanted to begin with how you came to this idea. You've been thinking about this for a long time. You've been working. I happen to know you've been working on this a number of years now. What was the first thing that got you interested in it?
You know, I'd say about 2.5 years ago, this idea stemmed from my own disconnection that I felt with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Here we were, maybe 2012. I just really had this overwhelming discomfort with myself and how, you know, here we were at war for the good part of a decade. We've seen 2 million young men and women come back. We've seen it all on the news. Yet I felt that too many of us, myself included, it was too easy for us to turn the page on the newspaper, change the channel. And I wondered if there was a project that I could come up with that somehow addressed the problems that the young men and women coming back from these two wars were having. At the time, you know, PTSD and its effects, alcoholism, marriages breaking up, suicide, this long list of problems. It was in the news, if not on a daily basis, certainly several times a week. It really bothered me. And I wondered, is there a project that would sort of address that issue, but also fit in with the mission of the Western Folklife Center, which is to sort of celebrate and document traditional culture. I went in all sorts of different directions.
Wait, you didn't start with Native Americans?
No. Wow. I looked into what is the folk music that returning veterans are writing, something that has happened in previous generations. And I found some interesting things, but it just didn't click for me. I also looked at how there was this movement, this back to the land movement to get into farming and ranching and things like that, that a lot of returning veterans were getting into. But it really wasn't happening in the rural West as much as it was in other parts of the country. And we as an organization serve the rural West. And then I remembered the first time I met a Native American veteran. It was in Elko, Nevada. Mm-hmm. I was there with my former colleague, Hal Cannon, doing interviews at a senior citizen center about, I don't even know what the topic was. And as we typically do whenever we're interviewing anybody about anything, at the very end we say, is there anything else you'd like to tell us? Did we forget to ask you something? We were interviewing this elderly man who I didn't even realize was Native American. And he says, yes, I want to say something. My name is Douglas Carson, and I am a Paiute Shoshone warrior, veteran of the Korean War. That time in my life, serving the United States in the military, was the proudest moment of my life and one that defined who I was. And I just wanted to – this is him talking now. Yeah. He said, I just want to say how proud I am to serve my country.
Did the irony of that statement strike you at the
it
time?
It still does. Yeah. It blew me away. I didn't know what to say. I got emotional. And do almost every time I tell this story, just the irony of it and just the earnestness and the conviction behind his words really stuck with me, but I didn't know what to do with it for years. And then when I was sort of flailing around looking for a story idea, I remembered that conversation. I said, you know what? Why don't I look into this? Mm-hmm. You know, is he alone in thinking this way? Or might there be more to it? And within 5 minutes of, you know, on the computer, I discovered that Native Americans serve in higher percentages than any other ethnic group in our country in the military. What? I couldn't believe it. And it wasn't long after that that I realized that sort of overlaid with their service, which in many ways is similar to how everybody else serves, there are all of these traditions, ceremonies, this sort of warrior spirituality that for those who hold on to the traditions is sort of overlaid on top of their service. And that includes, as you mentioned in your intro, ways of preparing people to go into battle and ways of bringing them back, cleansing them, reorienting them toward peacetime. So anyway, it was remembering that first encounter with a Native veteran that sent me on this course for the past couple of years.
I wanted to ask you about how it is that you think, 'cause I want to really break all of this down as you do in the film. Tell us about Edward Tick. Because he plays an important part of the story. Because Tick says in the film, the way Native Americans perceive of post-traumatic stress disorder is, as I actually mentioned in the introduction, it's a wound of the heart. Basically, this is a spiritual question, a spiritual issue.
Right. Another way he refers to it is as moral trauma.
Yeah.
You know, Edward Tick is a fascinating man. He has been working with Vietnam veterans since the 1970s. He was sort of recruited. He's from upstate New York, and he was recruited by his local like VFW or American Legion, something like that. He had graduated from school as a psychotherapist, ran into one of his old buddies who did come back recently from Vietnam, was very messed up. Ed was he was very receptive to the guy's problems, although he didn't know what exactly what to do.
Yeah.
But he listened, and that guy said, "You are helping all of us." And Edward began actually studying how warriors in his first sort of exploration of how other cultures cared for their returning warriors began with ancient Greece, believe it or not. He actually speaks Greek, and we speak Greek whenever we talk. but he was referencing the Iliad and the Odyssey, which in his interpretation was the Odyssey was Homer dealing with PTSD. That return home journey was all about the various demons that you have to deal with after
serving. Because it's a big story.
It's a big story.
Well, and stories are critical about that, right?
Absolutely. He went back to Greece. He actually went to a sanctuary. I can't remember what sanctuary it was. And after going to that sanctuary and just communing and thinking about the ancients, he turned around, was walking back, and he came across a tortoise, a big turtle, okay? And he took that as a message of, it's great that you're here, but you know where you need to go? Back to Turtle Island, which is how traditional peoples referred to our continent. That is what prompted him to start looking at Native American culture. And it all just started to, you know, I don't know. I can't remember where he had a couple of mentors in his life. I cannot remember the tribes that they are from. But, you know, he eventually, through patience and being inquisitive and respectful and all of those things, became familiar with just sort of native traditions. He studied, you know, there are differences within tribes. And one by one, he started looking at the way Native Americans define the trauma, treat the trauma. He's also looked at tribal cultures globally. You can find parallels to what Native Americans are doing here in America. You can find them in the Amazon. You can find them in Africa. You can find them in Southeast Asia. It's kind of like a global...
It's a universal.
Universal, yeah. Approach.
To healing warriors.
To healing the warrior's heart.
Let me play a clip. This is Edward Tick from Tocutilanitis's film, Healing the Warrior's Heart.
Native American traditions recognize that the wound is fundamentally a wound to the soul, a spiritual crisis and problem that needs to be responded to with specifically designed healing practices for warriors, and it needs to happen in a tribal context or community context.
Why that? Why is that? Why does it need to happen in a tribal context, a community context? I mean, this is a theme that comes up in the film from time to time. That in some way, the idea of being together as a community, that that the community takes on those wounds in some way as well.
Right. Exactly. First of all, as we know, when someone comes back from war and has problems, those problems do not sort of stop with that individual. They reverberate throughout the family, throughout the circle of friends, and things like that. So there are elements of Native traditional treatments that are only conducted by spiritual people with that individual one-on-one, but also built into it, there is a community involvement, a family involvement.
It's a process.
It's a process, and that provides support to that individual, and it also provides – one of the things that was a surprise to me was that a lot of the men and women coming back refer to two things that really haunt them, guilt and shame. Guilt and shame. Guilt at having survived when others have perished, and shame at something that they did that they wish that they could take back, okay? And when the community is involved, one of the steps that takes place in Native culture is the sharing of stories.
Yeah.
In the Blackfeet culture, it's the sharing of positive stories, but it's also the sharing of stories that are a burden. And the purpose of doing that is to share the response. The community, by being present at that storytelling, is sort of taking on the responsibility for those actions. You were there. You did what you thought was right at the moment. Now you wish you could take it back, but it's not all on you. You were there for us. We sent you. You were representing us. Therefore, we share in your burden.
You can take that burden and put it on us.
Exactly. I have mentioned that to some non-Native veterans of the, you know, one guy in particular of the Vietnam War generation who, like, you check in with me every once in a while. So how's the film coming? What'd you learn? You know, what's the latest thing you learned? And when I told that individual about this sharing of the burden, the next thing I knew, he wasn't talking. I was looking in his eyes. They were welling up. And he said, I have to go. That notion of lifting some of the burden was so powerful to that veteran that the conversation had to stop right there.
The process includes it begins with isolation and tending, as Edward Tick. He sort of breaks these steps down.
Right.
The storytelling is part of it. The one of the first, though, is that tending part of it. What is that? Just sort of binding up their emotional and their physical wounds. We bring you together and but you also have to think about it yourself. That's part of the process as well.
Right. You know, Ed, when he is referring to that isolation and tending, I think he's referring to steps that I think were separate and distinct in the old days.
Yeah.
But today, you know, things are not exactly the way that they would have been, you know, pre-contact or even 100 years ago. But I have seen a version of that isolation and tending, which is I've seen it. I have to think about what I can say and what I can't say. But in the context of a sweat lodge, which actually is a very complicated ceremony, there is a lot going on in a sweat lodge. I have seen a medicine man, spiritual person, spiritual leader, receive a combat veteran who's going through ceremony for the first time. He could be Native or he could be non-Native, and he does a special thing for that individual. It's done, you know, one time, and it's like sort of like the first time thing that happens.
Yeah.
When that person comes back, it's done only in the presence of other veterans, and it is done specifically to cleanse that person. I mean, there are movements and gestures which are these cleansing gestures over, you know, that veteran who is sort of standing, you know, in the lodge next to the medicine man, and there is a formal welcoming home, you know, that is given to that veteran by the medicine man. And that's sort of like step one, you know.
Yeah.
And it may or may not be exactly what Edward Tick is referring to, you know, from the old days. But it is definitely isolation from the non-veteran community.
Yeah.
And a specific tending. You just got back. We need to do this for you before anything else happens.
I want to ask about Martin Conley. The third.
Uh-huh. Inipoka.
Yeah, right, which means Buffalo Child.
Exactly.
A veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan. You met him up in the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in Hart Butte, Montana. Remarkable story, remarkable kid. I want to say kid because he seems young.
Yeah, he's 26, I think.
Yeah. Served in Iraq. He'd been home less than a year when you first started talking to him for the film. Let's talk a little bit about him, because this part of the story is really extraordinary that gets us to the whole idea of a sweat. He came back with PTSD. His mother said he came back a different person. Tell a little bit about him, because he went through the same process that a lot of veterans do, I imagine, medication and different therapies and things that just weren't really working.
Right. He actually started off within the tradition before he went to, I think it was Afghanistan first. He was taken through ceremony, given a bundle, which is a pouch, which is you know, given to him by a medicine man for protection. He went over there and started experiencing things that he just couldn't believe. In one point, he says, "How could the Creator be so cruel?" And he actually lost his way.
Yeah.
He lost his connection to the spirituality. He stopped praying. He became disconnected from that culture. And when he came back, he was doing alcohol and other stuff. He was being abusive to himself, to the people around him. I mean, he just had a major meltdown over the course of time. He's told me that had he not reconnected with his elder, his spiritual elder, he's not sure he'd be alive right now.
There's a remarkable moment, I have to say, in the film where you go out with him and he is, I'm not sure if he's hunting or just sort of, is he actually hunting?
Yeah.
He's deer hunting. And he tells you this story, and I want to play this section. Do you want to set this up for us? It's a moment where he's talking with someone. Someone tells him to. This actually happens to him. I'm not sure if it's Iraq or Afghanistan. A situation
of
Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Moment of combat. Now here he is, a young man who I'm sure spent his share of time hunting before, is now, and that's the context for what we're seeing. But you want to set this story up for us, or should we just play this part?
I'm not exactly sure where you're going to pick it up, but maybe I should just say that he was in Afghanistan. He and a colleague were given orders to go to the perimeter of their base because there was someone who was like monkeying around with the fence, and they had orders to shoot.
Yeah,
this
is the moment.
Yeah, okay. So maybe we should just play it.
Let's pick it up. From Taki Talanidis' film, Healing the Warrior's Heart.
And we were laying there, and it was at night. And I don't know what the hell, he told me I had to shoot. And I was like, all right, well, I had my night sight on, but he was pretty far. He was about 400 or 500 yards. And just the thought of putting my sight on a human being, I knew I couldn't have done it. And I couldn't do it until I start thinking of the guy as a damn deer. And after I did that, then it was okay. I could put my sight aperture on him.
I know. I had, when he told me that story, I was just sort of chilled to the bone. And what's interesting is a few veterans have seen this, documentary, and a couple of them have said, yep. Maybe it wasn't a deer, but I had to pretend that human being was something else in order to do my job. It's like that moment of when you're finally confronted with what you need to do and what a contradiction that is from what we've all been taught to do, since we were kids. You have to somehow cross that threshold.
So he goes out, and seeing the things that he saw made him, I guess the conventional way of saying he lost his faith or he lost his sense of spirituality. And when he came back, he finally returned to it. And he met a remarkable man, Leopard.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Leo, because he saved Martin's life. Is that right?
Yeah. I think that Martin would certainly say that. Leo is the medicine man, spiritual leader of that family and many others. And Leo actually, and this is mentioned in the piece, actually lives north of the border in Canada. In a way, this gives the Blackfeet traditionalists an advantage because up in Canada, for whatever reason, the language, spirituality, traditions are more alive north of the border than they are to the south. And you have people like Leo coming down into Montana, into the United States to do ceremony or to teach others who want to learn songs and ceremonies. So Leo is kind of a big deal for the tribe in terms of spirituality. He's an elder who went through boarding schools himself, but managed.
This is an important part of the story.
Yeah, and he managed to maintain his language and spirituality, even though he was punished as a kid for doing so. So he was very important to Martin's recovery.
Well, so let's set the scene. Martin starts to do the sweats again. Under the sort of influence of Leo, of course, and he even builds a sweat in his backyard.
That's right.
Martin does. And Leo comes in this particular moment to help him with the sweat in this scene. And I wanted to play this section of Leo talking about how you come into the world wet with nothing. Do you want to say something about this particular moment?
Yeah, this is as we are preparing the lodge. The first thing that happens, well, it had just snowed, so the lodge had like a foot and a half of snow on it. That had to be cleared off. A fire had to be started, and we were just sort of waiting for the stones to heat up. And, I had just sort of asked Leo, why does this work? Why is the lodge the answer? And basically, he talked about how there are parallels between what the lodge represents, what the sweat lodge represents, and being born or reborn. And it looks like the pregnant belly of a woman. You're going in there, either with no clothes on or almost no clothes on. It's dark. It's wet. They look at, or at least in his tradition, the sweat is looked at as a way to give new birth, new life to the spirit.
The old man, when he showed us about the sweat lodge, he talked about a lot of things. If you look at it real good and you look at the wound of a woman pregnant, same thing. When you came into this world, you came in wet with nothing. You go in here, you're going to sweat all that sickness, all what's bothering you, the hate. That's where you're going to leave it, in there.
And we should say, this is really remarkable. I'm not sure if I've ever heard of this happening before, but Leo actually, at least for a time, invites you and the camera to come in.
That was not the plan. This was a project where almost nothing went according to plan. And then randomly there'd be these magical things that happened along the way. That's an interesting backstory. After my first visit to the Blackfeet Reservation, I realized that I wanted to get to know Martin better, and I wanted to kind of follow him as a, significant part of the story. So I stayed in touch with him, and I kept up that relationship, and eventually felt comfortable enough asking Martin if he could put me in touch with his medicine man, Leo, and if there might be a way that we could interview Leo, maybe even document, preparing for a sweat. Well, Martin said, I don't know how he's going to react, but I'll give you his phone number. So I called Leo up in Canada, who from the first moment I could tell was just a wonderful, funny guy. So much humor in Indian country, which one of the things that I really appreciate about it. He was messing with me from the first moment. And when I told him what I was doing, he says, that sounds like it could be a good idea. You could be a nice guy who wants to do a good job, but I can't talk about these things over the phone. I can't commit to anything. I can't even tell you what I do until I meet you face to face. Now, at first I tried talking him out of it because it's like, well, Leo, we're about a 12-hour drive. I need to make arrangements for a cameraman, et cetera, et cetera. He goes, you know what? I have to do it this way. So I went up, basically planned the trip, kept my fingers crossed that it would work out with Leo. Martin and I went up to visit him in Canada. We spoke for 3 hours, at the end of which he said, okay, I'll work with you. And we made arrangements to do the sweat. The plan was that we could film the preparation, but when it was time to enter the lodge, the camera had to, disappear. Yeah. Okay, and it was very important to me to adhere to all these rules. Basically, everything that we filmed for this show had rules to it, and we needed to be respectful. So I was like, okay, that's fine. So the day came. And we prepared for the lodge, and, you know, Leo and I were sort of getting along pretty well. And it was just one of those really important days. It ended up being Veterans Day. We didn't even realize that we were sweating on, because the snowstorm delayed the, we were originally going to do it the day before. The snowstorm delayed the ceremony by a day. Leo had to cancel because it was snowing like a son of a gun up in Canada. The next day dawns bright and sunny. It was a gorgeous day.
And
he was able
to
do it. And we realized a couple of hours into it. But you know, do you realize what day this is? This is Veterans Day, November the 11th. That's another magical thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, we get ready. The stones are hot. It's time to enter the lodge. He sang a song outside the lodge, which we were allowed to record, and then I sent Doug away. The cameraman, Doug Monroe, I mean the director of photography, he did a fabulous job. So we go into the lodge. I had to sweat too. And I realize as I'm sitting there sort of, you know, cross-legged like you're supposed to be, that Leo is looking at me. And, you know, I kind of can tell that he's looking at me, but I'm afraid to look at him. And I kind of keep my eyes away. And then finally I just sort of look up and, you know, at his face. And Leo could never remember my name. So he says, Geronimo. That's what he called me. Geronimo. Where's your cameraman? I said, well, I just sent him, you know, far away, just like the plan was. He goes, if you want, he can come in for a couple of minutes until the pipe comes out. There's a that's when the ceremony really starts.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. And, you know, I go to the door, Doug, come back here. The camera's all shaky because he's just run like a tenth of a mile through, you know, a foot and a half of snow. And I didn't even have to ask a question. He knew what I needed to know. I wanted to know why that lodge is what helped Martin from his perspective as the medicine man. And I had also been curious about how he was able to maintain his faith, language, and culture, because I knew he had been through the boarding schools. I didn't even ask those questions. We go in. He goes, is your cameraman, you know, are you ready? And yes, I'm rolling, you know, says Doug. And he made his statement. And then he just sort of said, okay, that's it. You're done.
And it's amazing.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it really was. That's Taki Talanidis. His film is called Healing the Warrior's Heart. Next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, KUED is going to be screening the film at the Salt Lake City Public Library, the Marmalade Branch. Taki will be there for a Q&A following the film. There's limited seating, by the way, so you'll need to RSVP by Monday night. There's a link to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a short break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a documentary film that looks at the way Native American soldiers use the traditions of their people to heal themselves after going to war. The producer, Taki Talanidis, worked on this story for years about how Native cultures see the emotional impact of war as a wound to the soul that needs ritual and community. Taki's film is screening next week in Salt Lake City. We're rebroadcasting our conversation with him. The film is called Healing the Warrior's Heart. So I wanted to ask you about it was really did surprise me, this idea of why it is that Natives go into the military, as you say, proportionally far more than any other ethnic group in the United States. You mentioned that a little bit earlier, but I wanted you to say a little bit more about that. Why do they enlist? What is that connection? Because this brings us to another terrific character in the story, and that's Larry Cespuge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a question that I really had to find an answer to, because it just seems so ironic. And I would say it's a combination of things. There are, for a lot of people, as you know, there's a lot of poverty and lack of opportunity on reservations. And, you know, for a significant portion of young men and women who enlist, it is a way of acquiring a skill, of leaving the reservation, of, you know, creating a path, a career path for themselves. So we have to acknowledge that, and that is very important. But one of the things that I came to realize was that in traditional Native culture, especially for a male, a young man, going on the warrior's path was a very important thing. Becoming a warrior was a rite of passage. It was a way of becoming an adult after being a child. Yeah. And that didn't always, you know, involve going out and fighting necessarily. When it was necessary, yes, you did that as a warrior.
But it meant going on a journey.
And it also it was a way of going through that process, especially if you do end up going out and fighting, okay, was a very important rite of passage. It gave you status within the community. The leadership, you know, traditional leadership in Native communities and tribes, you know, was derived from people who were successful warriors because of all the qualities that they needed to do to do a good job at that. So when Native communities, tribes came into conflict with the United States, and that conflict ended with, you know, Wounded Knee and the end of the Indian Wars, okay, and they were relegated to reservations and things like that, that unfortunate history that we all know, one of the things that they lost was that very important rite of passage. That was a part of growing up as a male, okay? You needed that. So what ended up happening not very long after – I mean, there are reports – I mean, there are stories of Native Americans serving even before the Indian Wars ended, you know, in the Civil War, in the Revolutionary War. But when it really started to happen was – in the early 20th century, World War I, there were 12,000 Native Americans who volunteered. They weren't even citizens of the United States yet. They didn't become citizens until the mid-1920s. Yet, you know, they wanted to serve. So serving in the United States military, for those who wanted to hold on to that tradition, that rite of passage, that warriorhood, serving in the United States military replaced being, you know, a traditional warrior as a way to achieve that status.
Larry Sespuch talks about this in the film. He talks about seeing the flag, the way he interprets the colors of the flag, in a very different way. He talks about the red stripes he sees as Native peoples, as his people. The white stripes is the... I suppose white soldiers or white America more broadly, I guess. The blue being the land, stars being the lives that are lost, which is a really powerful thing. But I want to play another moment from Larry Sespuch. It's almost one of the most affecting parts of the film. He's speaking at a ceremony here in Utah, as a matter of fact. I guess it's in Fort Duchesne.
Exactly, the dedication of a veterans memorial there.
And he's talking about his son. A captain in the Marines, another part. Larry went off to war. His son went off to war. Another part of that sort of continuum of warrior culture. And he talks about how he took with him his medicine bag.
I think eagle feather.
Eagle feather, that's right.
He may have had the bag too.
No, that's right. The eagle feather. In fact, that's the critical part of the story. You want to say anything about this moment? Because it's such a powerful story that he tells us. We should play it.
Let's play it and then talk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Larry Sespuch from Taki Talanidis' film, Healing the Warrior's Heart.
We have an eagle feather that we prayed, gave to him. That's what he wore inside his flak vest. It's these Native ways. I remember many times coming off the carrier, I'd smell cedar, sweet grass,
Look around. Nobody's got cedar sweetgrass. It's my people praying for me at home. That's how a lot of us got back here. Think about this young man. He says, I want to make sure that drum does never stop and we can do our ceremonies. That's what we fight for. The way up.
That's another important theme in the film. What Larry Sesbuch is talking about is the fact that, and this has happened throughout history, where these ways have been sort of set aside or they've been diminished. And so would you talk about that part too? I mean, this is something Larry worries about. A lot of Native elders worry about that we're going to stay connected to these old traditions.
Exactly. I mean, that moment at the ceremony, at the dedication rather, was one that illustrates the tension that exists throughout, tribal country in the U.S., and that is that tension between those who are trying desperately to hold on to the ceremony and culture, and those who have turned away from it, and that is evident, on the Ute Reservation as well. And I think that Larry, during the course of that dedication, I mean, it was a beautiful ceremony, but he felt a need because of what others had said or not said during that day to, he felt a need to remind his people of the importance of, here we are at a veterans memorial. Let's not forget the veterans who served, but let's also not forget the warrior traditions that we have as a people that allowed us to get to where we are today. It was a source of strength for him. It continues to be a source of strength for his son, Sage. Okay, a lot of people around him are not connected anymore, and he felt it was very important to remind his own people that. We need to fight for these ceremonies too, and these traditions too, because otherwise we really will lose our way.
When we get back from a break, I want to talk about another really critical part of that story, and that is that these kinds of ceremonies, and this is where you come to in the film, these kinds of rituals, these kinds of ceremonies don't just need to be for Native Americans.
That's right.
That they have a broader usefulness, really, for veterans. Taki Telenitas, his film is called Healing the Warrior's Heart. And next Wednesday night, that's April 12th, KUED Channel 7 is going to be screening it at the Marmalade branch of the Salt Lake City Public Library. You're going to need to send an RSVP by Monday night if you want to go, since seating is limited. Just go to our website, radiowest.org, to get the details. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with producer Taki Telenitas. We're talking about his documentary film, Healing the Warrior's Heart, which is screening next Wednesday in Salt Lake City. You can get the details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Let's talk about whether or not, how can you apply something that's so particular to Native culture to people who aren't Native? Because this is one of the themes in the film, is that these kinds of ideas, these kinds of ceremonies, these kinds of techniques can help all veterans.
Right, and that's sort of the note that the film ends on. I should say that, there are some people, Native American people, spiritual leaders, who do feel that this is for
them. This is our thing.
This is our thing. Yeah. There is wide variation on how these things are interpreted. But there are others, and these are the people who talk to me in this film. There are other people, be they on the Blackfeet Reservation or here locally in Utah, who are ready to talk about these things A, because they feel a need to remind their own people of why it's important and we got to keep it alive, and B, because they truly feel that that these traditions can make a contribution to the – these folks are very patriotic. They love America, and they feel that they have something within these traditions that can help non-Native soldiers as well. And a case in point is, you know, right under our nose here in Salt Lake City. The Salt Lake City VA is one of just a handful in the nation that offers regularly scheduled sweat lodge ceremonies to its veteran patients. It originally began as something to meet the needs of returning Native American soldiers who are coming through the VA system. But over time, more and more non-Native veterans, some going back to the Vietnam generation, some from Desert Storm, and of course Iraq and Afghanistan, the more current wars, started attending, and these particular sweats were open to anybody, you know, who felt a need for that sort of spiritual approach to what they were to what they were experiencing. A lot of these guys were coming through a substance abuse program at the VA called Eagle's Nest, and I guess some of the people that were caregivers in that saw that while, you know, some of the guys that were going through ceremony were being helped by it, and they actually started suggesting to patients matriculating through that program, you know, there is this thing going on. It may or may not be for you, but you may want to give it a try. And I have had several non-Native veterans say that it's been key to their recovery. There may be other psychotherapies and more Western things that are a part of it. Okay, but this was really important. It was sort of it allowed them to push through a sort of block that they had been experiencing for a long time.
Why do you figure that is? As an observer, why do you figure that? What are the elements there that that there is some kind of ritual to pin this trauma too, that there's some process that it is communal? I mean, that you're working through. I mean, all of that, I guess.
Yeah. You know, I think it all sort of points to the power and complexity of a sweat lodge. I've had people tell me, oh, yeah, sweat lodge. Yeah, it's just like a sauna. You know, you get in there, you get really hot, you know? And it's like, yes, that is part of it. But I have come, having done it many times myself, I've just come to realize that it's so many things balled up, into one. Yes, it is hot, but when you're in the lodge, it is absolutely pitch dark. I have spent like hours trying to see my hand, which was, you know, 10 inches in front of my nose, and I couldn't see it. You can't see out. When you can't see out, where do you start looking?
Yeah.
You start looking in, okay? That blackness gives you at once a sense of being totally alone and having to deal with what's going on inside, yet you know that you are in a space with, you know, depending on the night, 18 others, 25 others. So you're both alone and you're in a community that is there to support you. Okay, within the lodge, you have the opportunity to you are directed to think about what is bothering you, the events, the individuals, those traumas. Okay, to take those things and as the medicine man Arnold Thomas put it, intertwine that pain, those thoughts into a prayer. Yeah. Pray for those victims. Pray for yourself. You're not just sort of sitting there, you know, doing. You're directed to take that pain and funnel it in a way that can help you out. So there's prayer in there. Very often, you know, veterans talk about that thing that's haunting them or what they did. It's confession.
Yeah.
Okay, it's confession. on top of everything else. So prayer, confession, psychotherapy, that symbolism of your being in a womb, you know that that's, that is
a safe place.
It's a safe place. You know, you're where you should be. You are connecting with the four elements, you know, the earth, the fire, the water, the air. Okay. So you are sort of taken back to the womb, so to speak, symbolically. Okay. And when you come out, you know, I've experienced it myself. You do feel clean. You do sleep well, which is a problem that a lot of, you know, why do a lot of these guys take the drugs and the alcohol? Because they cannot get through the night. Well, in the sweat, you have dealt directly with those demons that are keeping you up at night. Okay. And then at the end, you release them. And they'll come back. You know, this isn't a one-shot deal.
Yeah, of course.
You have to go over, but you know, I've had this one particular veteran, non-native veteran, tell me, you know what? There are times when I've woken up on a Wednesday, and man, I wanted that drink, I wanted that beer, you know, but I didn't take it. Why? Because you have to be clean to go through ceremony. You can't be high or drunk or, you know what I mean? That's a requirement. You have to be clean. And he goes, I may want that drink on Wednesday and Thursday, but I know I'm going to sweat on Friday and I'm going to wait. I'm going to hold off because the drink isn't going to help me as much as the ceremony is.
Taki Talanidis. Along with co-producer Gary Robinson, he created the documentary Healing the Warrior's Heart, which is screening this coming Wednesday night at the Marmalade branch of the Salt Lake City Public Library. Taki's going to be there following the film for a Q&A session. All of this is hosted by KUED Channel 7. You should know that seating is limited, so they're asking for RSVPs by the end of the day on Monday. Go to radiowest.org. You get the details. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.